9-1, State of Minnesota versus CLS.
Good morning. Thank you, first of all, for being here and participating in our remote arguments this morning. I want to make a couple opening remarks before we begin. Number one, you should be able to see the clock. And if you're not, or if it's too small, sometimes that's because you need to toggle into gallery view and out of active speaker view. But I want to make sure you can see that before you begin. So do a quick check. And secondly, we understand that given the nature of these arguments, there are from time to time interruptions. We'll try to do our best to keep them at a minimum. But if there is an interruption or a problem, if one of us freezes or something, we will make sure to accommodate that and allow you to have all the time to which you're entitled to present arguments to us this morning. We are also making an audio recording of this proceeding, and that is the only recording that's permitted. And last, before you begin, if you would do us the favor of pronouncing your name for us and also letting us know how we can refer to you and your client during this argument. Thank you. And the attorney for appellant, Mr. Braun, are you prepared to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, go ahead.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Thomas Braun on behalf of appellant CLS. We're here this morning regarding a district court order denying a petition for expungement. The appellant asserts that the district court has misapplied Minnesota statute section 609A.02 subdivision 3 parent 2, and that misapplication of law should be reviewed by this court on a de novo basis pursuant to State versus CWN. The overhaul of the expungement statute in 2014 by the legislature must be given proper legislative deference and effectuated by this court by requiring that the proper burden be applied when evaluating expungement on a statutory basis brought by CLS in this case. Statute section 609A.02 subdivision 3 essentially creates a two-step process for expungement. CLS in this case was charged with dissemination of a pornographic work. He received a stay of adjudication of sentence, was placed on probation, successfully completed his probationary terms, first applied for expungement related to the court's inherent authority, which was denied, but then came back before the very same court applying for expungement under 609A.02 subdivision 3, which creates a legislative presumption in favor of expungement when a stay of adjudication...
Mr. Braun, I'm going to jump in here. I'm going to make sure you have time to address all these arguments, but on the burden of proof issue, the shifting burden, did you see something in the district court order that specifically stated whether or not it had shifted the burden? Or is this something we're left to sort of put the pieces together and do our best guess at what which party was required to bear the burden of proof ultimately?
Yeah, I think the court's analysis of each of the factors really kind of shows how the court analyzed the burden of proof. For example, in the order, page 7, factor 5, the court views that factor as essentially being neutral. I think because of the statutory burden shifting, each of those factors should weigh in favor of the defendant unless there is clear and convincing evidence presented by the state which would oppose or support the opposition of the denial of the expungement. So with the court essentially saying the factor is neutral and starting off on an even playing field, which I think is kind of the basis upon which the court normally...
When I read the district court's order, I didn't see a specific statement that indicated it had decided to shift the burden. It does cite the statute, but then as I'm looking at the analysis, I'm trying first off not just to review the analysis, but to determine from that analysis whether or not the burden was shifted. And so there's language in the analysis that I can look to. But I do take a bit of an issue with the idea that there's no such thing as a neutral the factor can be neutral in the way that the statute is set up, because I make a distinction between clear and convincing proof of facts, evidence of facts, and weighing of those, balancing of those factors, right? You could, I suppose, have clear and convincing evidence that a fact is proven, and then based on those facts, the factor itself is neutral. And so I envision a world, even with the shifting burdens and clear and convincing, where you could have neutral factors, even though facts are proven by an agency to a certain degree of proof, standard of proof, right? So I guess wondering, the very specific question is, do you see the district court making a statement about burden of proof?
No, I don't think the court, you know, does make a statement about the burden of proof. And I think your question, Your Honor, speaks to the larger issue in this case, and that's the role of the court in a statutory expungement case. Is the role of the court as a fact finder or as a gatekeeper to expungement? Because the record in this case is very, very limited from the state's perspective. You know, if you look at the transcript, essentially the only objection that was made by the state occurs on page 4, lines 1 through 3, stating that the severity of the offense and that the fact that this individual doesn't have to register, presumably as a sex offender, is the basis of the state's objection. So if that's the record, that's the evidence that the state is proffering in its opposition to the expungement motion, then, you know, what is the court's job? Is it to evaluate simply only those factors, or is it to go further? Because it goes further, much further in this case, in denying the expungement. And when you look at the court's order, you know, the first factor on page 5 talks about the seriousness of the offense, and the appellant concedes this is a serious offense. We stated that in our brief, and we talked about that at the time of the hearing. But then when you get into the other factors, factor 2, where we're talking about the risk posed to individuals or society, you know, the state didn't make any argument related to that factor. Yet the court makes a finding that because of the gravity of harm that would be inflicted on another child victim if the defendant were to reoffend is very high. For that reason, the court views that factor as weighing against the defendant.
Can I jump in? Maybe you're getting to this, and I'm just going to preempt you a bit here. What role does the seriousness of the offense play in factor 2? It's clearly a factor 1, but what role does the seriousness of the prior offense play in weighing risk or harm to the public as noted in factor 2? Any role at all, or a little bit, or what role does it play?
Yeah, I think it's good. Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's offense specific, really. I mean, here we have a case where it's a very serious offense, yet there has been mitigation of risk by way of treatment that was rendered during probation and the discharge of the defendant pursuant to abiding by his terms of probation, abiding by and completing sexual offender specific treatment with Dr. James Alsdorf. You know, those factors, I think, are significant in mitigating risk, yet the court just kind of goes to the nature of the offense here and suggests that the nature really outweighs the factual information that was submitted in the appellant's petition, which mitigates risk. And again, I think it speaks to the role of the court in evaluating these factors in terms of, are you looking at the evidence in the record? And it's very limited here. Or are you going beyond? And I think that the court goes beyond to justify that factor weighs in favor or against the appellant's petition for expungement. Factor 3.
Mr. Braun, before you move to factor 3. And then I don't want to ask all the questions, so I think if you would want to jump in, feel free. But my follow-up is going to be looking at the statutory factor and how it's been interpreted by courts of appeal. What is it that is causing the harm that we're concerned about when looking just at factor 2?
Right. Well, I think the concern for public safety is, I think, the legislative concern here in identifying factor 2. Obviously, public safety is tantamount to whether...
But what is the thing in factor 2 that is threatening public safety or risking public safety? Isn't it the sealing of the record that has to cause the harm?
Correct. Right. That's what the court should be examining. Yet, and I think that the court is speaking to that here. If the if the file were sealed and there was another offense, the gravity of the offense would be very high because it'd be a minor, a child that's a, you know, obviously a minor. So the court utilized that reasoning, but I think that really speaks to the gravity of the offense, not the risk, because, you know, the risk for reoffense, if in the event that the offense was, or excuse me, the case was sealed, I think is relatively low, given the mitigating factors that we cited in our brief. You know, factor three, I think, is also worth noting, because the court notes that there's been a relatively short time period between the discharge of the appellant's probation and his petition for expungement. The legislature was very clear. 1 year is the time frame that's necessary. And the court stating that it's really not long enough or it's too short doesn't give legislative deference to the clear intent of the statute, which is that individuals under these circumstances, where you've got either a stay of adjudication or a continuance for dismissal, some type of diversionary program, need not wait longer. Yet the court is substituting its judgment for that of the legislature and saying that it's not long enough. And because it's not long enough, it weighs against the defendant. And I think
isn't the specific factor the length of time since the crime occurred? I think I'm quoting the statute, right? So what role does length of time since the end of probation play in reviewing the second factor, which is looking at the length of time since the crime occurred?
Well, I think in serious offenses, right, we have lengthy terms of probation. First degree criminal sexual conduct, I think, is a 20-year probationary sentence. You know, the legislature deems that supervision period to be, I think, consonant with the seriousness of the offense. And then what the legislature has done for the expungement statute is to tack on an additional year, right, of time where an individual needs to be law-abiding. So, you know, those time periods have been specified and clearly identified by the legislature, and yet the court seems to be suggesting that it's not long enough. And I think that, again, doesn't give the legislative deference that's necessary, and then uses that against the defendant.
And are you, in a sense, arguing that a finding like this sort of supports your overriding argument that the district court did not appropriately place the burden of persuasion on the state?
Correct. That's exactly right. You know, factor four, I think, again, is a demonstration that the burden was not placed on the state, because in the petition, the appellant states a number of things that he did which resulted in rehabilitation following the crime, which included community service, included going through treatment with Dr. Alsdorf, which included completing sex offender specific treatment. You know, all of these things that he did individually, and it should be the state's burden to prove that this factor doesn't support expungement, yet the court finds the factor neutral in light of the fact that the state presented no evidence to suggest that this factor weighed against the defendant in support of his expungement petition. Factor five, I think, is, I've already commented on that, you know, to the extent that the court views that factor as neutral. And I think it would be very helpful for this court to identify for district courts what their role is in engaging, you know, these factors. I think you have to look to the record in each case to determine what the judge has available to him or her in determining whether expungement is appropriate. And it's the state's burden to present clear and convincing evidence. You know, it's that, and that elevated evidentiary standard, which is also required by the legislature, because the legislature, again, intends for individuals in these limited cases, states of adjudication, diversionary programs, to be able to get expungement, to move on with their lives, to seal these records. So it's only in those very limited cases where you have a disposition that's been agreed to or ordered by the court that is going to essentially result in an acquittal of the charges. So to then be able to come back and seal records so that an individual can move on with their lives here 6 years later after completing all the terms and conditions that were ordered by the court. Your Honors, I think that the court is very used to seeing these expungement cases evaluated under the discretion of the court. The MDT factors, district court judges are very familiar with, and the balancing and the competing interests where the state and the petitioner seeking expungement start out on an equal playing field. And I think that that's what the court, you know, certainly did here by, you know, starting out these factors being neutral and not requiring the state to submit evidence, but rather the court in this matter went into the record and found facts itself, which weighed against the.
You've said this a couple of times. I just want to make sure that, as I understand it, the burden on the state in a presumptive expungement case is a burden of persuasion, not a burden of production, right?
Right, a burden of persuasion.
The state didn't have to come up with lots of evidence, but should have made arguments that would have persuaded. And your argument, I think, is the district court should have indicated somehow that it understood the state had the burden of persuasion.
Correct. And to argue against these factors, if in fact it intended to argue against these factors, you know, factor six is a classic example of the court weighing into the defendant's ability to abide, you know, provide by to his family or for his family on an economic basis. That was the basis of his petition. No argument by the state on that factor. So we believe that all of these factors can, you know, reach us to the conclusion that the court misapplied the statute and the legislative intent. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Braun. Mr. Barnes, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jake Barnes, Senior Assistant Wabasha County Attorney. Right away, I want to note a couple of big things that were already hit on. The burden of persuasion, not the burden of production. The law does not require that the state appear at these hearings and submit exhibits. It does not require that we appear and submit testimony. It does not require that we appear and submit affidavits. We are allowed to use the record. We're allowed to point the court towards the record. We're allowed to argue the record in order to persuade. If we were to follow what I believe counsel for appellant is suggesting, it is a slippery slope where we start requiring the state to produce evidence at these sort of hearings. That's not
what Mr. Barnes, I understand your argument. I think we're all on the same page. The difference between production and using or relying on evidence produced by the other side in order to establish what you have to. But I want to make sure I'm clear. When you're saying burden of persuasion, the statute itself says grant the petition shall grant unless the agency establishes by clear and convincing evidence. So really, when you say persuasion, we mean proof. It's a burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence, and that's the standard of proof. When you agree that the state bears the burden and the clear and convincing is the standard.
Yes, Your Honor. Reading the statute, plain language, yes, absolutely.
And then the next question, just so I'm clear, because there are some indications from Mr. Braun's argument that he takes that to mean that when weighing the factors and doing the balancing test, that each factor must strongly favor the state, that there's no such thing as neutral. What is your position regarding the possibility of a neutral factor, a factor being neutral, not weighing in either favor?
Although I could not produce case law on point, I have frequently seen it in practice where district court judges are finding factors as neutral. As factors, as we're all familiar with, are not elements. We don't need every single one. It's a balance. That's what factors are. We're balancing. Does that address your question?
Sort of. I mean, I guess the language regarding the standard of proof, clear and convincing evidence, does that have any impact on how strongly a factor must weigh in favor of a petition or against a petition in the court's analysis? Does the standard of proof language impact the balancing test at all, in your view?
No. The state obviously bears the burden of establishing and ensuring that the record has the evidence necessary to permit a court to make its findings. The court here has discretion. The district court has discretion when evaluating these factors. And that discretion permits it to say, I can't make a determination based on these, but based on the totality of everything I have, when I go through and I review all of these records and I review all these factors, I'm able to come to a conclusion. I, of course, in this case, am speaking for a district court judge.
As I understand from the record, the state's position in the district court focused, I think, solely or primarily on the notion that this was such a serious offense, and because there was a stay of adjudication, there's no registration. And that was the persuasive argument presented to the district court. First off, am I right that that was the state's persuasive effort in the district court, was on that factor?
We, if we were to review the transcript, that was the crux of the state's argument.
That's true, is that, does the state meet its burden of persuasion? If that's true, doesn't that support the appellant's argument here that the district court is disregarding clear statutory direction to consider all these other factors?
I don't believe the district court in any way misapplied the law, nor do I believe that it shifted burdens. The state at the hearing directed the court to the record and whole, directed the court to specific previous arguments, all which are part of the record in addressing these elements broadly. We did offer to go into further argument. However, as the transcript reflects, the district court asked the parties the questions that it wanted answers to after having reviewed the record. The district court in its order very clearly cites the appropriate statute. The district court knew the burdens that were established in that statute and indicated that it was following the law. This is another point.
How do we know the district court applied the burden? I don't see the burden of persuasion as required by the law. I don't see anything in the written order that specifically says that. So I wonder, are the findings inadequate for us to review the question of whether the district court appropriately placed the burden of persuasion on the state?
I don't believe it's required that in the district court's order, and I'm not sure if this is what you're saying, but I don't believe it's required in the district court order that the judge would necessarily have to put the burden is upon the state. Instead, the court can simply do as courts do throughout the state, note the statute, which outlines the burden, which is what happened here. There is nothing to indicate that the judge did not apply that statute that the court cited in its decision.
Can I follow up on one or two aspects about the factors themselves, because it's your position that there was no error of law. And so I'm curious, you agree that there's case law tying the risk in factor two to sealing the record, as opposed to tying it to the harm that might come from a reoffense. You would agree that there's case law that ties it to the sealing, right?
Yes, I would agree.
Okay, and then if that's true, then wouldn't it be an error of law for the district court to only focus on the severity of the underlying offense when deciding factor two, and not consider the harm of sealing the record, and only consider the harm of a new offense? Would that be an error of law?
I'm not sure if it'd be an error of law, and I know it's not a helpful answer. I do believe in reading the district court's order as it evaluates factor two, that it did look at the risk of harm for potentially sealing. And as we're examining that risk of harm really focuses on the severity of the offense and the potential risk of this offender reoffending. This is a serious offense, and it is one where people are victimized. Children are victimized, and the court properly looked at this and said, for this particular offense, knowing the facts and having the record that I have before me, the risk here and the risk of harm is great enough.
I think that Judge Bryan's question, and correct me if I'm wrong, Judge Bryan, really relates to whether the district court's findings with respect to factor two were adequate, given the case law that ties the risk to the sealing of the records.
And I do believe it was adequate.
Okay, so let's assume that it wasn't adequate. If the district court's finding was not adequate on factor two, and we're talking about a balancing, does the case necessarily have to be remanded to the district court for reevaluation of that factor and taking that evaluation into account with respect to all the other factors?
I don't believe so. If this court were to determine that factor two was improperly applied, then I think the appropriate step here would be to do a de novo review, look at the limited record that you have, make your own determinations. I would again stress that these are factors. They are 12 factors, and they are all to be considered and weighed in coming to this determination. I would further note that factor 12 permits the court to consider other things. These aren't the things the court is necessarily limited to. The court can look at other things that it deems to be relevant.
Can the court consider the nature and severity of the underlying crime at factor 12?
I believe the court would be permitted to do that, perhaps through a lens of how that seriousness would impact how the, forgive me, I'm thinking, I believe it can, it should not be a repeat though. It should not be a repeat to answer your question. There should be another analysis that is done. I believe that's what the law would require.
And I know your time is dwindling, but will you briefly address the sort of obvious discrepancy between what the factor three in the statute says about the comparison of time? We're looking at a period of time from when the crime occurred, and compare that to what the district court, the analysis and the way the district court stated that factor, and give us your argument as to why that's not an error of law.
Well, I believe the court intended to acknowledge that the length of time in total has not been great. There are cases that have come before our appellate courts where we're looking at people who have 10 plus years. That's not this case. It is not great since the time has occurred. Counsel's indicated that 1 year is all that is necessary. 1 year is a triggering event, but it is not binding. That's why we have that third factor, the length of time since the crime occurred. It's something the court's allowed to consider, and it did so. I note that I have some very limited time. I've hit the main points that I wanted to beyond the brief. I'm not sure if Mr. Johnson has anything to add, but at this time I would reserve just for him in the event that he does, unless Your Honor have questions for me specifically. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Benjamin Johnson from the Attorney General's Office, appearing as on behalf of the respondents, the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Department of Health. I have just a short period of time here, and so I would refer the court to our briefs, or if the court has any questions for me, I'm happy to answer them. The long and short of it, though, Your Honors, is that we would urge the court to affirm the district court's denial of the expungement petition here. I think based on the record before the court, there is no error of law with respect to the court's interpretation of the statute. The court makes clear in its order, I think it's on page 5, that it found by clear and convincing evidence that the interests of the public and public safety outweighed the disadvantages to the appellant here. And so that is the appropriate standard. It was applied correctly based on the plain language of the court's order. Now, with respect to the individual factors, and I've listened to the court's questions, and I think those are good ones with respect to factors. I think overall, we need to keep in mind that those 12 factors are part of a balancing test. And the standard of review in reviewing the court's appropriate weighing of those factors is abuse of discretion. And I don't see anything in this record that would demonstrate that the district court abused its wide discretion here in determining that those factors weighed against expungement. And I think the one significant thing to keep in mind, and that may distinguish this case from some of the others that appellant cites, including the RHB case and others, is that although the appellant was petitioning with the statutory presumption in his favor because of a stay of adjudication, we have a guilty plea here to a very serious crime. And so the case law suggests that there isn't any particular number of factors that need to weigh for or against. There isn't any hard and fast rules. And when the nature of the crime is very serious, coupled with an analysis of the other factors, that is sufficient to deny expungement. I would point the court to the SMC case that we cite in our brief. It's a 2017 Court of Appeals case. The BTH case, that's a 2016 Court of Appeals case, that I'll support our position in that regard. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Braun, rebuttal.
Thank you. We seem to keep coming back to the seriousness of the offense, you know, in terms of the overall view of the appellant's expungement petition. That's one factor. And frankly, based on the record, when the only thing that the governmental agency is saying is that we're opposed to the expungement in this case because it's a very serious offense. You know, the legislature chose to make expungement allowable for this offense, like any other. So the fact that this is a serious offense, it still needs to be given, the petition needs to be given the legislative deference and the presumptions required under the statute, as it would any other offense. And I think the court, in analyzing these factors, specifically factor 12, continues to go back to the seriousness of the offense when evaluating these different factors. Specifically, the court states, the court is concerned that the defendant may be unsupervised if he were to practice and is concerned about the possible interaction with minor patients. This weighs against the defendant. I think that goes to the seriousness of the offense. And I think it goes to the other issue that we're raising before the court is, what is the district court's judge's job under these circumstances? We're now talking about potential reoffense, recidivism in his employment when these issues are not being raised by the state. That's not part of the record in the expungement hearing. So,
Mr. Braun, if I can get back to the way you opened this rebuttal and make a very precise question. If a district court said factors 2 through 12 weigh ever so slightly in favor of granting the petition, but factor 1 overwhelmingly supports a denial of the petition, and on that basis, weighing all the factors together, it's denied, is that, in your view, an abuse of discretion, or would that be something acceptable under the statute?
You know, I think that there would have to be more context given to, each factor and why. I think the very nature that the legislature has allowed this offense to qualify for legislative or for the presumption in favor of the expungement, okay, under these circumstances, you can't just say, well, because he received a stay of adjudication related to this offense, that he can't get it because the offense is so severe that even if everything else is good and weighing in his favor, that the nature of the offense is just too serious. The legislature's got the ability to make that call. It exempts certain offenses from the expungement statute. It could have chose to exempt this offense. It did not. So I don't think that the serious or the offense in and of itself can outweigh every other factor. And here there are significant persuasive reasons why the rehabilitative efforts and the individual circumstances of the appellant in connection with the legislative presumption weighing in favor of the expungement are persuasive. You know, this occurred 6 years ago. You know, factor 10 talks about the fact that the victim in this case is an unidentifiable minor and that weighs against the defendant. Again, that factor wasn't argued by the state. This was a computer crime that was committed in isolation. And in the absence of any other criminal history related to this appellant. So we're dealing with an offense that is now 6 years old. This appellant has done everything that has been asked of him. And you have to wonder, you know, and think about what the legislative intent is of allowing for the expungement and the presumption in this case with stays of adjudication and diversion to allow these matters to be sealed. I think it's pretty clear that the legislature wants people to be able to be rehabilitated, to move on from serious mistakes once there has been rehabilitation, compliance with court orders, an order from the court that is unique in the matter and the fact that this results in a dismissal. So an individual shouldn't have to pay for a mistake that's occurred a very long time ago when every other thing during probation and a successful 1 year period of no additional offenses occurred after the discharge of probation. That's the legislative intent. I think all of those factors, you know, have been checked in this case, but I think the more concerning issue is how the court went about it and how they looked at the factors and went outside the record to justify the denial of the expungement in this case. And it's for those reasons we're asking the court to reverse the district court order in this matter. Thank you.
All right, thank you both very much. Well, all three of you for your arguments this morning, and we will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe. I hope you have a nice day.
You too, thank you.